Lecture 24, Blake, Mythic Universes and Poetry.
If there is one statement which sums up the achievement of William Blake, the poet we'll be looking at in this lecture, that statement is, "I must create my own system or be enslaved by another man's." Blake himself speaking, of course, here. And it's a proclamation of the extremist individualism. What Blake is laying out for himself here is the creation or the invention of a whole new method of poetry. Not a new style. I mean, every major writer does that. But as Blake says, an as yet undreamed of, uninvented system. Now, for Blake, this new system would involve the creation of whole mythic universes. In more practical, materialistic aspects, it would involve the making of a new form of illustrated poetry book, for which we still have no adequate name, and which his own time was wholly unequipped to make sense of. Now, Shelley, a romantic contemporary of Blake's, famously decreed that the poet was the unacknowledged legislator of mankind. The poet was to mankind, that is, what Washington was, for example, to the new United States of America. Presidential power, or its equivalent, was not enough for William Blake, however. For him, the poet must be something even more than that. He must be a kind of God, a creator. Now, to read Blake requires, I think, first of all, to learn how to read Blake. And once that trick is mastered, few writers in English literature are so rewarding. Now, that proposition may be questioned by those who find themselves immune, and there are such, who find themselves immune to his arguably excessive claims on the reader. Why, they may ask, should we be enslaved, to use his own formulation, by Blake's system? But one thing is incontrovertible, even by Blake skeptics. No writer is as original or as innovative as William Blake is. Now, before putting some flesh on those bones, which are they're very large observations, let's look at the man himself and his life. And that life will tell us much about his work. Where, literally, was William Blake, as we say, coming from? Well, he was born in 1757, which puts him in the first generation or wave of what we call the Romantic Revival. He was the son of a draper or a tailor in central London. Like Keats, another great innovator whom we'll be looking at shortly, Blake was a Cockney and the son of a humble but decent metropolitan tradesman. Now, other ranks of life produced writers at this time, and the Romantics whom we're looking at often came from the upper tiers of society. And it's important to be aware of social ranks when one looks at these writers, because they infect even the poetry. Byron, Lord Byron, was born into the purple, the aristocracy. He was the friend of princes and kings. Shelley was born in the upper classes. Wordsworth, Scott and Coleridge, all writers we'll be looking at, were born in the respectable professional middle classes, the rank of life occupied by lawyers, doctors and clergymen. Keats and Blake were on the lowest respectable rung. Beneath them was the abyss, a place where no poetry was possible, the lower ranks of society, the working classes. Blake had a minimal schooling, but by the age of 11, his extraordinary artistic skills were already recognised, and he had 3 years training at a drawing school. It was a humble place, not the Royal Academy, the establishment art institution, for which he incidentally would have a lifelong scorn. At the age of 14, young William was apprenticed to a London engraver in a firm which was largely making illustrations for books, but also easily reproduced pictures to decorate middle-class homes. There was a rage for illustration at this time, a huge visual appetite, and techniques and processes had evolved to the point that the market for this appetite, this trade, this market, could be supplied cheaply. The same thing would happen with photography a century later. Now, printers, as Benjamin Franklin, who was also a period a London printer, were notorious, that Franklin confirms this, printers were notoriously radical. Why? Well, because they were necessarily literate. They were probably the most literate profession in the land, actually. Obviously, composing was done by hand at this time. And a lot of radical literature passed under their professional eye. They knew what was going on politically. They read it. They had to read it. It was their trade. From his teens onward, Blake was imbued with revolutionary spirit and sentiment. Now, it was, of course, the age of revolutions. Blake admiringly observed both the French and the American revolutions, and in later life would write majestically prophetic long poems about those earth-shaking events. But while politically radical, Blake was at the same time enthusiastically religious, but very nonconformist in his faith. Here, as everywhere else, he made his own systems. He was very early influenced by Unitarianism and excited by the way in which it, as he would say, remade the Christian system so as to free it from the established Anglican Church. One could, if you were a Unitarian, be a devout Christian and still be a rebel. In his 20s, Blake was skilled enough to set up his own shop in London, Soho, which is the bohemian artistic heart of the capital, and even today. That business, alas, failed, but by now Blake was moving in advanced radical circles and was directly influenced by the thinking of William Godwin, the political revolutionary, by Thomas Paine, and by the feminist we've just been looking at, Mary Wollstonecraft. And the strands of his artistic, philosophical, metaphysical life come together, they're bound together, in a novel series of books of poetry, which he made as much as wrote. He made them by means of illustration, by means of inventing new systems of religious allegory, and merging the whole thing into some new ensemble, which was startlingly new then, and still, in fact, strikes us as highly innovative. In this early, most accessible period of his poetic career, at a period when the French Revolution was at its most idealistically revolutionary, Blake produced The Songs of Innocence and Experience and The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. Now, English literature had seen nothing like them before. They were followed by the first of the great prophetic books, vast symbolic poems and interlinked designs, The French Revolution in 1791, America, a Prophecy in 1793, Visions of the Daughters of Albion, 1793. Albion is England, of course. It's all geopolitical stuff, and dauntingly hard to understand unless, that is, one also understands the Blakean system. Blake continued to write, to design, and to agitate. At one low point in his life, he was even tried for treason. It wasn't a safe time to be revolutionary in England, or anywhere. Few of his contemporaries, least of all his contemporary poets, were aware of him. They didn't know he existed, or of his remarkable achievements. They were just beneath the radar. His paintings did not sell. His prophetic books were produced in batches of a few score. Pitiably few survive, and there's a scramble in any auction house nowadays when they come on the market. In a mint condition, Songs of Innocence can fetch hundreds of thousands of dollars. Blake lived obscurely for much of his time in Soho, where a broken plaque, symbolically in Marshall Street, among the city's brothels and drinking dens still there, commemorates his residence. He died in 1827 and is buried in an unmarked grave. No pilgrimage is possible to his tomb as it is to those of the other great romantics. He died obscure. He never knew during his life that he would after death, quite a long time after his death, be world famous. And William Blake, to be honest, probably would not have cared that much. Now, Blake's, as I say, is a life without any privilege, educational or social advantage whatsoever. The Bible, Shakespeare, Milton, and the engraver's tools were placed in his hands, together with the most exciting political ideas of his time. And out of this mix, animated by his genius, he made his poetry. Now, I want to concentrate on two of Blake's works, which may, I think, be taken as the gateways to the great prophetic books. They're works which give us the key to that Blakean system which I've been talking about. The first of those is The Songs of Innocence and Experience. And the second, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. Now, without going a syllable further than those titles, we can learn much about the essential dynamic of Blake's poetry. In a word, that dynamic is dialectic. And what does that word dialectic mean? Literally two forces coming together in conflict to produce a third thing and a higher thing. Blake himself gives us a classic definition of dialectic in one of his proverbial utterances, in fact, the Marriage of Heaven and Hell. Note particularly the opening statement when I read it about contraries. Without contraries is no progression. Attraction and repulsion, reason and energy, love and hate are necessary to human existence. From these contraries spring what the religious call good and evil. Good is the passive that obeys reason. Evil is the active springing from energy. Good is heaven, evil is hell. Now, Blake can be seen, along with Hegel, as one of the fathers of Marxism, a political theory founded on the dialectical triad of thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Those two things coming together and producing a third thing, contraries. Let's move away from politics to our proper concern in these lectures, poetry. Innocence and experience are clearly moral contraries. In the two collections of songs, Blake suggestively opposes examples of innocence and experience from natural creation, from history, and from society. And the big question is, can a person who is innocent, that is, unexperienced, be truly good? Or does that achievement, goodness, require experience? Now, if we believed that, and also believed that only the good go to heaven, we'd rejoice more when a baby, the incarnation of innocence, dies at birth rather than grieving when it dies. But we don't, because there is more than blank purity to life. This is one of the points which Blake is stressing. Now, Blake does not attempt to argue this through as a philosopher might. He's not a philosopher, he's a poet. Poetry, as Keats points out, at least the kind of poetry that Keats and Blake valued, does not work in this way. It nothing affirmeth, as Keats says. It merely depicts things in their maximum complexity, using all the tools that language, raised to its highest level, the level that we call literary, allows. Now, to demonstrate how this complexity operates in Blake, consider two opposed lyrics. The first is from the Songs of Innocence and is called The Lamb. Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Gave thee life and bid thee feed by the stream and o'er the mead? Gave thee clothing of delight, softest clothing, woolly bright? Gave thee such a tender voice, making all the vales rejoice? Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? It's like a nursery rhyme. It's consciously so. Little lamb, I'll tell thee. Little lamb, I'll tell thee. He is called by thy name, for he calls himself a lamb. He is meek and he is mild. He became a little child. I a child, and thou a lamb. We are called by his name. Little lamb, God bless thee. Little lamb, God bless thee. Now, as the poem indicates, the lamb is one of the conventional symbols of Christ. And the poem itself is, as I say, nursery rhyme simple. It's a token of childlike, lamb-like innocence. But the mature ram, when the lamb grows up, is sexual. The lamb is innocent of sex. Now, Blake was well aware of the complications of carnal desire and discusses it frequently in his poetry. God made the lamb, but why then did the innocent lamb have to be sacrificed? Think of Abraham and Isaac and the ritual sacrifices of lambs in many of the world's great religions. The poem, you'll notice, pivoted on a question, but the larger question is unanswered. It hovers. Now, consider the equivalent partnering poem in the Songs of Experience. It's a famous, much-quoted lyric, but it merits contextual examination, alongside Our Lamb, I mean. It is not, I would suggest, a simple text, as the Lamb poem is. It's Tiger, Tiger. You probably know it well. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire in thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire? And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain, in what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil, what dread grasp, dare its deadly terrors clasp? When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he, who made the lamb, make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? The tiger is, of course, the anti-type of the lamb. Tigers kill and eat lambs, and if they come across them, it's not cruelty, it's their nature. In the design he made for that, for this poem, Blake has an image of the tiger smiling. It's very strange. It's, like he's had lamb for lunch. Now, where the force of destruction is involved, the answer is not as simple as, did he who made the lamb make thee? The answer, yes or no, is not forthcoming. As I say, it hovers. The two poems stare across the volumes at each other. They are, in Blake's terms, contraries. And the hinted answer to that big hovering question is that without the destructive tiger, without crucifixion, to allegorize it in Christian terms, the innocence of the lamb would be nothing. It would be empty. It would be literally bloodless. And it is the blood of the lamb, not the innocence of the lamb, which the Christian William Blake believes will save us. And us who are anything but innocent. As I say, it's worth looking at the design which Blake put together when he made the original woodcut, or the original engraving, rather, for that poem, Tiger, Tiger. Let's move on. Blake's poetry, in short, takes us into exciting mysteries, strange territories. And typically, we emerge from his poetry less certain of things than we were when we entered. He disturbs us. And always in his poetry, it is the unanswered questions which are mysteriously the pathways to higher understanding. Even if we struggle to make sense, as a rationalist might say, make sense of that understanding. Let me give one other example, a very short one from the Songs of Experience. The poem is called The Sick Rose. Very beautiful poem, very short and very simple. O Rose, thou art sick. The invisible worm that flies in the night in the howling storm has found out thy bed of crimson joy, and his dark secret love does thy life destroy. Roses wither and die. Poets have always known that and written about it. But this rose is not merely conforming to the eternal law of mutability, vegetation and decay. It is sick. But this is the big question in this little poem. What is the nature of that sickness? What precisely is killing the rose? Well, it's a worm, but it's not the kind of parasite which the off-the-shelf weed killer will cure. The worm, of course, is in the Bible an image of Satan. It's also phallic. The crucial word in this poem, and it's a minute or two, I think, until we realise the fact, is secret. His dark, secret love does thy life destroy. Now, how different would the poem be if it read, its insatiable love does thy life destroy? Blake, we must remember, was a sexual anarchist, a philosophy which he found justified in the writings of William Godwin. Love does not destroy if it is open. It is only when it is furtive and ashamed of itself that it destroys. This is the nature of the sickness, that it is secret love. Now, one can agree or disagree with that proposition. Obviously, everyone in their life has to make a decision on that point. But it's one of the foundation elements in the poem's idiosyncratic system. And we shall never comprehend Blake's poetry unless we take it and similarly radical, passionately held beliefs of his on board. We don't have to agree with them, but we have to know about them. Now, Blake was particularly attracted to and fascinated by the poetry of Milton, specifically Paradise Lost. Now, remember that poem? It's founded on the great opposition between two mighty adversaries or contraries, God and Satan. But Milton, as Blake believed, wrote in fetters. His imagination perceived something that his reason would not fully let him know. This is how Blake puts it, and he was the first to make this much-repeated critical observation about Paradise Lost and the moral contradiction at that poem's core. What Blake wrote was the following. The reason Milton wrote in fetters when he wrote of angels and God, and at liberty when of the devils and hell, is because he was a true poet and of the devil's party without knowing it. Devastating last three words. Now, he didn't mean by this, of course, that Milton was a Satanist. What he meant was that a part of Milton understood that Adam and Eve could never have fulfilled their destiny without Satan, without the fall, without the crushing responsibility of regaining paradise, which they'd lost. Without contraries, without Satan, that progression would never have been possible. Therefore, and perversely, Satan was the instrument of religious progress. He was, in Blake's system, the necessary component, and in Milton's too, if the earlier poet had but known it and trusted what he inwardly, intuitively knew, but could not write because the fetters of Puritanism, of orthodoxy, were too strong at that time. Now, it's a pretty thought to visualise Blake and Milton arguing this point in Poet's Heaven. Blake wrote and rewrote Paradise Lost, although he didn't call his poems that, throughout his career. Time and again he revisits the questions that Milton's poem posed. It was an obsession with him. And as the latent contradictions in Genesis, as we discussed earlier, were an obsession with Milton, so Milton was an obsession with Blake. Now, despite the ferociously authoritarian voice tone of Blake's poems, which bark out truths, daring the reader to disagree, Blake never quite worked out the answer to the Milton problem. But the problem itself is both clearer and more beautiful for his investigation of it. With this in mind, let's turn to the other of those early gateway poems, as I've called them, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. If ever there were a divorced couple in the realm of metaphysics, one would think it was these two. But dialectician that he is, Blake is using the term marriage as a synonym for synthesis, as the Marxist would say. So he's talking not about a marriage in the sense of a marriage ceremony, but to some extent the fusion of those contraries which are omnipresent in his work. The marriage, as it presents itself on the page, will probably not strike the reader's eye as a poem at all. But it seems to be a grab bag of manifesto, proverbs, blank verse, epigrams. Much of it's in prose, and it has much of what looked like Mosaic commandments, hundreds of them, not just 10. Take, for instance, the section which states the devil's philosophy as a series of truths. So this is the third of those truths. Energy is eternal delight. Those who restrain desire do so because theirs is weak enough to be restrained, and the restrainer or reason usurps its place and governs the unwilling. And being restrained, it by degrees becomes passive, till it is only the shadow of desire. The history of this is written in Paradise Lost, and the governor or reason is called Messiah. It's an extraordinarily contradictory and difficult passage, that. But again, one sees it is Satan who, although the universal mischief maker, is the vessel of truth as well. A particularly revealing trove of Blakean truth is found elsewhere in the poem, in the section called The Proverbs of Hell. And the allusion, of course, is to the Book of Proverbs in the Bible. Now, let me just give some samples of these hellish proverbs as Blake sees them. The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. Prudence is a rich, ugly old maid courted by incapacity. He who desires but acts not breeds pestilence. A fool sees not the same tree that a wise man sees. He whose face gives no light shall never become a star. The hours of folly are measured by the clock, but of wisdom no clock can measure. If the fool would persist in his folly, he would become wise. Every one of those could be a text for a whole Victorian novel. One could have a three-hour discussion on Blake taking any one of those proverbs. But the truest of them all, I believe, is a fool sees not the same tree that a wise man sees, which I would adapt as the fool reads not the same poem that a wise person reads. And it's a truth, I think, which is particularly appropriate to Blake. Blake wrote the Marriage of Heaven and Hell in what is seen as his most Swedenborgian phase, when, that is, he was most intensely under the influence of the radical theologian Swedenborg. He outgrew that phase, although that sect still regard him as one of their most important prophets, and his poem, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, as one of the most eloquent expositions of Swedenborgianism. Blake, over the next 15 years of his life, progressed further down his own idiosyncratic path. And those who accompany him can often lose their way. The prophetic books are like James Joyce's later works. They're not for amateurs or the faint of heart, or for those disinclined to spend many hours preparation reading them and coming to them. He remained always, however, deeply connected to the traditions of English literature as he valued it. He wrote, for example, or rewrote, Chaucer. For him, the Bible was the greatest of literary books, as well as a vessel of divine truth, as was poetry. And much of his work, particularly his pictorial designs, rewrite or repicture, recycle, as one might say, the Bible. Now, unlike Wordsworth, whom we'll be looking at shortly, Blake never compromised with his early radical Republican revolutionary beliefs. He is also probably the most misread or misunderstood poet in the language, and nowhere more than in that poem, which is ritually chanted out in international soccer matches nowadays and at party political broadcasts and conferences. I'm referring, of course, to Jerusalem, as that poem of Blake's was put to music by Hubert Parry during the darkest days of the First World War. Blake's poem alludes to the legend that in the lost years of Christ between his childhood and where the Gospels pick up his 30th year, the Saviour visited England, that he preached at Glastonbury, specifically, where the country's biggest pop music festival is held annually and where inevitably the poem is sung out every year. This is the poem, Jerusalem. And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green? And was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills? And was Jerusalem builded here among these dark satanic mills? Bring me my bow of burning gold, bring me my arrows of desire, bring me my spear, O clouds unfold, bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand, till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. You probably know the song. And did those feet in ancient times walk upon England's mountains green? It's very, very, very good tune. Now, the poem, as it's been popularised, I'm sorry to say, is an extravagantly, not say disgusting, chauvinistic, patriotic anthem. That's how it's misread. It's not at all what Blake had in mind when he wrote it. The dark satanic mills are not, as is often asserted, the new and exploitative textile factories of the early Industrial Revolution, but more probably they're the established churches, which Blake loathed as prisons of the soul and mind. His arrows of desire, which he talks about, are frankly sexual desire. In short, this isn't traditional England, green and pleasant land, Tory England, which he's celebrating, but a vision of the Blakean anarchist utopia, a place of complete freedom of belief and free love. Now, this is not, one can be sure, what the many see when they bellow it out at football matches, but it's an ill wind that blows no good. And at the very least, the popularity of Jerusalem has installed Blake where he never was during his life, at the very centre of English life and culture. It is, however one reads or misreads him, where William Blake deserves to be. He is arguably, in that very sort of impressive company of romantics, he is one of the giants. And if he demands that we learn his system in order to appreciate his gigantic achievement, we should do him that service and learn his system. And it's very rewarding too.